Good evening and welcome to another Alaska Identity Project show here on KTOO News, 104.3 in Alaska's capital. My name is Adrienne Lopez, and it's great to be back on the air interviewing those around the state making an impact in our great state of Alaska, the last frontier. It's always great to have your participation, so if you are out there and listening to this evening and you want to ask questions of our exciting guests we have, don't forget you can follow us on Twitter at Alaska ID Project. You can like us on Facebook, and you can also write to me at adriennek@gmail.com with questions for the guests. Tonight, the topic is Norway, and we will be talking to a few of the representatives that were part of the delegation of over 45 Alaskans that went to Norway a few weeks ago on 5 and 10 days of meetings and visits. In order to provide insight into this policy tour, I invited Alaska Senator Hollis French, Executive Director of the JEDC, Brian Holst, and then the last half of the show, we'll be talking with Representative from Homer, Paul Seaton. A little background on Hollis French. He's a Democratic member of the Alaska Senate representing the M District since 2003. He's chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's an attorney and part owner of a local restaurant, the Snow City Cafe, up in Anchorage, I believe. He's also he graduated from the University of Alaska, Anchorage, and Cornell Law School. Brian Holst joined the Juneau Economic Development Council in February 2008 as its executive director. He's worked in community and economic development for the past 20 years, many places abroad. He was a Peace Corps volunteer, small business development, and international consultant. So welcome to the show, both Brian and Hollis. I hope you guys are both there.
I'm here, Adrienne. It's Hollis. Yeah, thanks. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And actually, we have Brian just here in the studio. So
great to be here. Thanks, Adrienne, for having us.
You guys taking the time to kind of do this first part of the show. Now, before we get started, I just pulled some fun facts from Niels Andreasen's report that he's actually going to be putting out about this trip. Niels is the executive director of the Institute of the North. He says in a couple of the fun little facts that Norway is a country that is plugged into media networks. Norwegians typically read 3 newspapers a day, so they seem to be very up on current events. He said all seven parties are also considered left and progressive, or all seven parties in Norway would be considered left and progressive in the United States. And that Norwegians work to live rather than living to work. People are very productive but also want to enjoy life. So with that, I'll start with you, Senator French. Just give us a little bit of background on this trip, the policy tour, and why you went and kind of expectations before you went on this trip to Norway.
You know, it was a fascinating opportunity, and the Institute of the North did a great job in putting the agenda together. You know, for me, the basic thrust of the trip was to look at two things: Norway's relationship with the oil industry, and how Norway has managed its vast oil wealth. You know, for me, it was sort of eye-opening to see a country that, for example, many years ago got themselves all connected onto one big grid that is powered probably 90% by hydroelectric power. Norway has invested heavily in hydro, did so and began doing so before the oil boom came along. Interestingly enough, their oil boom started about the same year ours did, in 1969.
Really?
Yeah,
huh.
They, you know, our Prudhoe exploration well was drilled in 69, and their big first offshore find was in 69 as well.
Oh, great. Now, Brian, what were some of your expectations before going on the trip, and why did you feel like this was an important thing to take part in and go?
Well, as here in Juneau, Alaska, nothing is more important to the economy in Juneau, Alaska than oil and gas. And that's something I think folks in the rest of the state and in Juneau here, we don't always understand and mm-hmm. recall. I think you're aware that 85% of the state budget is funded by oil revenues, tax revenues. And so it's a hugely important part of our economy, and there are big questions out there as to how best do we maximize the return to Alaskans,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do we maximize the production. And it seemed to be, as you mentioned at the beginning of the radio show, I spent 20 years abroad working internationally, and I know that I've benefited tremendously from seeing how other people do things. And I was sure that going to another country would be a great way to get a different perspective that could be valuable. It won't match directly to Alaska, as I'm sure we'll talk about tonight, but would be very valuable, and I wasn't disappointed.
Yeah, excellent. Now, Hollis, can you just mention a couple of the other people or participants? I know there were 45 people in this delegation. Who everybody represented, if it was industry, more policymakers, and maybe just a couple of the lessons learned, or as you spent 5 days intensely traveling around the country, some of these lessons learned from those visits.
Sure, we had a good, strong delegation from my body, the state Senate. I think there were actually 8 state senators there, including the Senate President, Gary Stevens, Tom Wagner, the co-chair of the Senate Resources Committee, Lyman Hoffman and Johnny Ellis, both members of the Senate Finance Committee, myself, of course. But there were also, you know, sort of a broad cross-section of folks like Brian, you know, sort of representing more of the business side. Bradford Keithley, a well-known oil tax attorney here in Anchorage. Rebecca Logan from the Associated Builders, the ABC. Actually, I think she's with the Alliance now. But she's, you know, a strong sort of an industry person. And so there was a good cross-section of people. And really, we just jumped right in. The very first morning we were off, Monday morning, you know, 9 o'clock in the bus off to meet the United States ambassador to Norway. And we spent the morning there getting a briefing from him on the country, and then went that afternoon to sort of the equivalent of the Norwegian State Department, where we started meeting with officials from the Norwegian government. And I'll never forget, you know, the second gentleman who spoke to us that day, whose name escapes me right at the moment, but you know, he was a sort of a seasoned Norwegian official who'd been working in oil and gas matters for 30 years. And we brought up the fact that we were having this raging debate at home about oil taxes and what we were supposed to do with, you know, sort of this enormous question on our hands. And he said in a very matter-of-fact way, you know, just sort of like, you know, everyone knows this. He says, well, of course the oil industry will always ask for lower taxes. You know, as if, you know, you can't be persuaded by the fact that they're just simply making that request. And it was really sort of refreshing for me to hear sort of a high government official, you know, sort of stand up for his own country in sort of a very patriotic way and assert, you know, their sovereignty against, you know, the industry, which, you know, is so powerful and often so persuasive here at home.
Yeah, exactly. Well, on that note, Brian, you mentioned in one of our updates after your trip that you think that Norway provides a valuable example for Alaska with how they manage their oil and gas wealth. Would you like to make any more comments on that and what you saw there?
Sure. And there's a lot to this.
I know.
And the differences, but I think that they and Alaska both share this. In our Constitution, Article 8 talks about the resources for Alaskans. And in Norway, clearly, we heard over and over again this attitude that these are our resources that we need to manage for the benefit of Norwegians. And I think that's a great starting point, because it helps to define how they think about the private sector and the oil and gas industry. They want them to do well, but the oil and gas industry really becomes a partner with the state to be able to extract this state resource for the benefit of people in Norway. And I think sometimes in Alaska, we think of the company first, and we think this is private, this is a, you know, market economy, and we need to put forth first what are the interests of the private sector and protect those interests. That's very true. But they make a distinction in their corporate tax structure. There's a corporate tax that's applied to the oil and gas companies that's the same as any other company in Norway. And then they have, not different from us, but then they have this special tax for, they call it a special tax on oil and gas, which is an additional 50%. They get to the point where their oil and gas taxes are as high or perhaps higher than those in Alaska, which puts us right up there at some of the places where the taxes are the highest.
Now, Hollis, on the same question, do you think this is going to, kind of what you learned in some of the people that participated that are in the Senate and House, will this affect some of the discussions this year coming up in January?
I think very much so. And Brian's right. You know, Norway taxes, Norway takes about 78% of The value of a barrel of oil at $100, Alaska probably takes 75%. That's including federal taxes as well. So it's sort of total government take. So we do tax a little bit less overall here in Alaska than they do in Norway. But there were two sort of big things we learned. One's, I think, transferable, one not. You know, first of all, the Norwegian government formed an oil company in 1972 called Statoil. And they basically ran that oil company to explore for produce oil and gas and sell it. They went public back, I think, around 2001. Two-thirds of the company is now owned by the Norwegian government. One-third is owned by the public. And they you know, bid for leases. They take leases. They, you know, invest money and explore for oil and gas just like any other oil company. And the money, of course, flows back to the Norwegian people. They also do something called state direct financial investment, SDFI. And you're going to hear a lot about this in this next coming session because it's something very intriguing to many of us. It's a way for the state to simply just put down money alongside other oil companies and take a position in a lease, take a position in a field, take a position in a exploration well, and share in the risk and share in the reward. And we're beginning to explore this as an alternative to the governor's oil tax plan, which for many of us looks like a giveaway. It looks like we're simply going to reduce oil taxes by $8 billion over the next 5 years and hope for the best and hope that money is invested in Alaska and hope that more exploration and more development takes place. With this SDFI idea, you can simply put the money down instead of pushing the money across the table and hoping. You take $1 billion and say, we're going to invest it in more gas handling, in more heavy oil exploration, in more drilling. And it's going to be spent in Alaska for our fields and our oil.
Oh. And so you think there's consensus among those on the trip? Brian, you comment.
I think there was a lot of interest in it, you know, not only from the legislative side, but also from the business side. I know Bradford Keithley, this oil tax attorney I referred earlier, you know, very influential in his circles, and he likes this idea. It's something I think where, you know, you constantly see, if you pay attention to news, you'll constantly see oil companies partnering up with one another on leases. Rarely do you see, you know, even the biggest, Exxon or BP or Conoco, taking 100% of a lease. They like to spread the risk out. It's so expensive and it's so risky. They spread that risk out, and they're constantly looking for other people to be capital investors on these leases. The state could do that. The state could put some of its own money down on some of these ventures and share in the risk, share in the reward, and make certain that the money that we use is spent in Alaska to produce Alaskan oil.
Yeah.
And I think there's some interesting additional benefits that they talked about that we need to explore a little further about the SDFI and how it works. By the state investing in these wells, in these leases, what they're able to do when they do this is the private company that's making the investment, let's say it's a $100 million investment. Well, it's difficult for one company to make that investment. There's often a few partners. But what they suggested was that it makes it easier for smaller players to also participate in. Because if you're willing to make a $100 million investment, maybe you don't want to make it all in just one well.
Yeah.
And just to make this simple, let's assume that SDFI would be $50 million. If the state would take half that investment, then this private company could actually get to a second well. And what it appears to do is, one, incentivize, make it easier for the investments to occur, but it also seems to give the state greater control over which resources are developed. And again, back to the attitude that was really prevalent in the minds of the Norwegian officials involved in oil that we talked to, it is that they're really focused on, we want to encourage and make sure that our resource is accessed. And this SDFI appears to be a tool that not only does it increase the return to the state, but it also helps to direct and encourage access to the resource.
Wow. Now, we could go on all night about this topic, I know you guys. But on a similar note, there was talk of renewable energy as well on a trip, right, Hollis? I know you mentioned it just in the beginning, but expand on that a little bit and what they've done there and also how that would apply to Alaska? I know we've been working on it here in Southeast with developing a cluster initiative.
Sure. Renewable energy has been a national priority of Norway's for a long time. And I don't think they sort of approached it in the way we do, as sort of an alternative. They looked at their geography. They looked at what the tools they had available to them. And Norway's a steep country with a lot of rainfall, with a lot of snowpack. Mm-hmm. And it's very much like Southeast, where hydro just makes absolutely perfect sense. What they then did was make it a national priority to connect the entire country with a grid, which is something, of course, that Southeast has not been able to finish doing because of the enormous cost of some of those interties, connecting one island to another island. But Norway did that, and it's given them enormous benefits. The cost of electricity is fairly stable across the country. You know, imagine what that would do for the state of Alaska to have low-cost electricity available in the remoter bush regions. It's such a problem there, you know, simply heating your home or providing energy to a business. So that's been a priority of Norway's for some time. They're absolute, you know, international leaders in hydroelectricity. They are exporting that knowledge around the world, and they're looking now at some interesting cutting-edge technologies, like, you know, using the power that's generated when fresh water mixes with salt water at the mouth of a river. And, of course, that was something that really made us sit up straight and listen carefully, because it's we've got a lot of rivers in Alaska. There's a lot of mixing zones. And, you know, that's still in the very development phases. They're just getting their first pilot project off the ground. But we were all ears and all eyes when we were being told about that.
Huh. So that's technology that we could bring over here.
Very much so.
Definitely. Now, Brian, having worked with this issue here in Southeast, do you have any comments on something that maybe you could have brought back to the work you're doing?
One of the things that struck me, both about the oil and gas industry as well as renewable energy, is the commitment to learn and understand from this industry as well. So it goes from not just supplying 97% of their energy through hydropower, which is through renewable energy, which is what Norway has achieved. They actually consume very little of the oil and gas that they produce, even though they're one of the largest producers worldwide of both oil and gas. They were very deliberate about, okay, not only are we going to produce this for ourselves, but we're going to learn how to, we're going to turn this into a market for us. So they sell renewable energy technology. Mm-hmm. They're leaders in that. They go to other countries. That produces an additional benefit. Not only are they meeting their needs, but they're innovative, and they're able to bring back new wealth that they earn from outside, and newer technologies which increase efficiencies, which is this very positive cycle that they're reaping tremendous benefits from. It's fascinating to see that actually work.
Yeah. Now, what about the Arctic issues? I know we're both similar. We have similar geography, similar latitude. How did those issues translate? How have we developed relationships in the past between the Arctic councils, I guess it would be Hollis, and was the topic of climate change brought up in some of these discussions?
You know, it was not a focus of the trip, but certainly it's something that the Norwegians are paying very close attention to. We spoke a little bit about the Law of the Sea Treaty. I don't know how well your listeners are informed about this, but it's basically an international agreement on how to sort of arrange for property rights and boundaries in the oceans. It's something that was passed sort of set forth a long time ago. The United States Senate has failed to ratify it because of a few holdouts. Both Senator Murkowski and Senator Begich support its ratification. It's something that we in the legislature have supported ratifying through resolutions. And, the U.S. ambassador there, of course, was urging us to continue to push for its ratification. It's an important part of international diplomacy and making sure that Alaska and the United States maintains a strong claim on these vast resources that sit north of Alaska's North Slope. But really what was interesting, you know, was sort of Norway's ability to balance that off against, you know, their sort of own hard-headed need to develop. They're very, very sensitive, environmentally, but they're also, you know, sort of aware that their resource base like ours is in oil. All of their oil is offshore. There's no onshore developments like we have at Prudhoe and Kuparuk and Alpine and so forth. Every single bit of oil development takes place offshore in Norway. So they've had to even be more sort of exacting in their environmental standards. And there's just no, and as I say, they're sort of hard-headed in sort of a very positive way. You just don't, you know, there's just no, you just have to abide by certain standards or you're not going to be given a license. They're not going to be invited to do business.
So they have a little higher standard in regulatory environment as well, right?
They're just tough. I mean, it was sort of refreshing.
And at the end of our trip, we had the opportunity to meet with the Canadian ambassador to Norway as well. And Canada, of course, is also a northern country,
sure.
And they have signed the treaty of the Law of the Sea as well. And there was when you start to look from the world, from the very top of the world, there are actually a fairly small number of countries that have interest in this area. And as the Canadian ambassador was sharing with us, is that what struck him is the level of collaboration that exists. He said that the conflicts, the few ones that we have are really just disagreements that get worked out over time, but it's amazingly harmonious amongst the players at the top because the interests are everyone can benefit from, and everyone's, from his point of view, the nations at the top of the world see that the benefit is from this active collaboration. As the climate changes, whatever your position on that is, the climate that's creating new opportunities for trade, for fisheries development, and of course for accessing oil and gas.
Yeah, of course. I know that the Lieutenant Governor has been pretty active in Arctic issues, and actually he'll be on the show next week, so hopefully we'll get to talk about some of this as well. So Hollis, is the role of government different there in Norway than here in Alaska and the United States? I mean, the role they take more in giving social benefits to their citizens as well?
Oh, so I mean, certainly. I mean, and that's I think one of the things that we all found interesting, but you sort of have to recognize that the political climate here at home is not going to probably accept a state-run oil company. Frankly, we're still struggling to provide health care to all of our citizens, something that most Norwegians take for granted. A few years ago, just by coincidence, my wife and I took in a Norwegian exchange student, a high school student, and we had him living in our home for a year. We reconnected with him when we were there, and he is in his fourth year of completely state paid for college.
Wow.
The Norwegian government will pay for any Norwegian young person to go to college, whether at home or abroad. And, they just take a very sort of, and yet for them, it's, the benefit is producing an intelligent and motivated workforce.
Yeah.
They really sort of see that, beyond oil, you're going to have your resources and your people. And, you just can't get by in today's world with a second-rate education and a second-rate workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And no one's going to do it for you except for you. The Norwegians recognize that, and this is something, we've been pushing here at home. So let's invest in education. Let's make sure that every single person is as intelligent, as creative, as skilled as possible. And that's how you're going to solve a lot of the country's problems. They really, really take a very progressive view on that. And as you mentioned at the outset, the entire spectrum of politics there is fairly narrow and it's center left.
Mm.
And so, they just don't sort of get the hard-edged sort of throw-down political debates that we get here. We had an interesting session at the Norwegian Parliament. We got a nice lecture from one of their, what they call the ministers, members of parliament. It's a unicameral parliament. It's one body. It's not a House and Senate. It's one body. And then we were sort of walked through the chamber by the sergeant-at-arms, a very matter-of-fact, sort of down-to-earth sergeant-at-arms kind of person. But they discussed how one day there was a vote coming up, and the dominant party, the majority party, was missing some of its members. And the minority party sort of could have taken advantage of that and sort of, won a vote. But they didn't, sort of knowing that that's not the Norwegian way, that the Norwegian way is to cooperate, to be more gentlemanly, more cordial. And it really comes from I think, coalition politics. One of the One more quick fact is that in Norway there are five dominant political parties, not just two. So coalition governments are a fact of life, have been that way for a long time, and I think it breeds a sort of cooperation and civility that we don't see much of, certainly not in Washington.
No.
But I think Juno's a special case with our coalition we've had going for 6 years now in the Senate.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Hollis, just real quick, have your constituents given you positive feedback on your trip? Have you heard any of this kind of junket?
You know, they have. I took some personal travel afterwards, but when I got home, I spent about 4 days writing up a very lengthy report, you know, a sort of a day-by-day, meeting-by-meeting account of what we did there, and got that out to my constituents. Most of them really appreciated hearing about what I'd done, and so it has been fairly positive. You know, people are interested in how other parts of the world operate, how they do things, and to be able to bring that knowledge back about the relative sameness in the taxation policies, the differences in the structure of the state owning an oil company, and yet, you know, sort of being open to new ideas like SDFI, I think folks can see, you know, the benefit. There's billions of dollars at stake right now today in the governor's oil tax bill, and for us to take some time to educate ourselves about what's going on in the rest of the world could make a big difference in the state's financial future.
Yeah, for sure. Now, Brian, you also had a chance to go through Iceland. I don't know if we want to move there right now, but I also don't have a lot of time left before we have our next guest, so I wanted you at least to be able to get in a little bit about how this smaller group broke away, I guess, on the way back and went to Iceland for a trip.
Yeah, it was actually a some from the same group, and then it was people from the Institute of the North, Jack Hickel, who is the son of Walter Hickel.
Former governor.
Yes. Secretary of Interior, has been in a dialogue with Iceland and the president of Iceland for some time. And so I was able to have this invited to this very lovely dinner with seven Alaskans and the president at his home, which was just fun and that.
Fun.
But the conversation was about the commons, which is something that the Institute of North and Governor Hickel was very important to him. Was how do we manage resources that are common to all of us? And and different from Norway, Iceland, not a country that has a rich endowment of oil or gas, but it has done extremely well. They have a geothermal potential there. That not only have they exploited that to the benefit of prosperity of their own country, but now they're world experts in that technology, and they're able to sell that to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun in our conversation. We've been promoting cluster development, sort of industry engagement. And the president of Iceland was commented that he is engaged in a geothermal cluster with the Harvard Institute on Competitiveness, same institute that we've also looked to for guidance on the Alaska cluster initiatives.
Yeah.
And so in the end, there's this interest in seeing if Alaskan businesses can learn from, similar to Norway, can learn from how Iceland, as a country that is not rich in other resources, very isolated, and has done extremely well in the area of renewable energy. I think that's especially important for our part of Alaska, where we're not endowed with oil and gas, but we do have a lot of other beautiful, wonderful resources. And how do we manage those resources? So that was the takeaway from my short visit on 2 days back. Took advantage of Iceland's being on the path of Iceland Air. It was great. It was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be there.
Did you get a picture of the president?
I did, of course. Okay. Wouldn't miss that.
Now, what about on this trip to Norway, and both Hollis or Brian could answer this, was there anything that the Alaskan delegation taught to the Norwegians? Was there something that you guys presented that they learned from us on this trip? What do we have to share?
Well, the one area that we had some good-natured sort of back and forth on was in the area of fish farming. Norway, of course, is a leader in fish farming. They have been exporting their farm fish around the world for some time now, and we made certain that they knew that while we admired their prowess, we knew which fish was better. We would always be eating a wild Alaska fish every chance we got, and so that was kind of one thing. Another thing, probably more serious, was that when we were speaking to the ambassador, he made sure that we knew that when it comes to innovation, when it comes to, you know, sort of solving problems, that, you know, that he will always pick the United States over any other nation on the earth. And I think that was a nice point to be reminded of. You know, as much as we look to the Norwegians for this idea or that idea, you know, we're problem solvers here in the United States and problem solvers here in Alaska. And, you know, no one's going to take a back, you know, we're not going to take a back seat to anybody. And one more sort of specific on this was in the area of search and rescue. When it comes to Arctic search and rescue, the world looks to the standards set very much so by the Alaska National Guard. You know, they are internationally recognized as leaders in search and rescue, and as more and more exploration work and tourism takes place in the Arctic, you know, I think folks are going to be looking at how we manage that that specific aspect right here at home.
Brian? No, well, Brian, you're here in the Southeast. There's been a lot of Norwegians in small communities throughout the Southeast. Petersburg has a little Norway festival.
Sure, absolutely, our Petersburg connection.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of connections between the two places.
There are. Yeah, there's a lot to learn. I think one of the things that we talked about on our before we returned was there are tremendous lessons that we can learn from Norway, and yet we all know that this is Alaska, and it's very different. And we don't want anyone to, and I'm sure Senator Hollis would agree, we don't want anyone to think that all of a sudden we've all become Norwegians and we want to turn Alaska into Norway. Hollis was good to note the comments of our ambassador who reminded us at the very beginning about really about the, you know, how strong we are in many things. So we really went there to look at those parts of what Norway does that are really exceptional. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that everything that Norway does is tremendously exceptional. It doesn't mean that everything that we do is not up to par.
Yeah.
But they did have, say, a really valuable way of looking, especially at oil and gas, that is really relevant to us. One thing about oil and gas I just want to throw out there that really struck me was the fact that they haven't changed their oil and gas policy for about 19 years now, if I remember correctly. And they were very that was a very important point to them. I remember at a conversation we had with at the Ministry of Finance, and we had some tax experts there, some perhaps younger people, and they were they had some suggestions on how to even change their tax system. But they quickly said, yeah, but you know, we're not going to make
clearly
any changes, because the stability in once they felt like they got it right, the stability there is extremely important, and they believe that is part of why they're successful in exploiting their oil and gas well, because the rules are what they are, everybody knows them, and people have confidence that these rules aren't going to change, and that's an environment where businesses can make long-term investments.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
You know, I'm really glad Brian brought that point up. It is an excellent point. You know, the tax debate in Norway is over. It's you know, it's a foregone conclusion that you're going to operate under these rules now and for the foreseeable future. And frankly, I think what we're seeing in Alaska right now is, you know, industry sensing an opportunity to get a better tax deal. And they're willing to press, you know, as hard as they possibly can to, you know, move billions of dollars from the state side of the ledger over to theirs. You know, they're just not engaged in that same sort of political activity in Norway because it's not a realistic possibility, despite the fact that both places tax very much the same. You know, frankly, Alaska taxes a little bit less than Norway does. And yet industry is very active there. They're investing in Norway. You know, so many of the arguments we hear at home ring a little more false, at least they do for me, having seen, you know, another nation's policies in effect and working very well for them.
Last quick question, I guess. I know there's a lot more we could ask, and I'll ask a few other things to Paul Seaton when he comes on, especially about fisheries. But, you know, they just went through this horrible tragedy, and I didn't see any comments. Well, maybe I just saw Brian's report. But what was the climate there after this kind of
tragic? No, it was still very much on
tragic.
It was still very much on people's minds. We visited the site where in the city of Oslo, where one of the two atrocities occurred, and you know, from what we were told beforehand and what we understood once we were there is that the Norwegian people are fairly reserved people very a bit stoic, might be. Mm. I don't want to to stereotype too much. But yes, it was sensitive to people. We were very polite. President Gary Stevens of the Senate was there, and he acted in some cases as our sort of de facto spokesperson, as the most senior person in the delegation. And he reiterated often, you know, mm-hmm. that we felt very badly for what happened. Yet the conversation didn't go into it deeply at all. It seemed that people were satisfied that we were pleased that we were interested and concerned, yet they didn't want to delve on it.
Well,
but they also, you know, they have a very active civil society that is a whole other conversation I won't go into. That in many ways they feel that it takes a great mind to be able to see a silver lining in all this, but it's sort of reinforced somebody from the civil society leadership group came and spoke to us, sort of reinforced to citizens of Norway that while we think we really have it good here, mm-hmm. We need to do some things better, and we have weaknesses here, mm-hmm. but it's something that we're not going to change who we are. But we're going to try to figure out how we can continue to live and work better.
Yeah, I have that reflection. Any last comments, Senator French?
No, it was a great trip. And one of the benefits is I'm now friends with Brian. You know, I'd seen him around Juneau some before, but we got to spend some time together. And you know, it's one of the benefits of having sort of time on the road to meet new people. And so I've got a new friend in Juneau. And I'll just say that you know, we are going to be looking very, very closely at, you know, how to manage our oil wealth this next session. Norway has done a great job. Their permanent fund is 10 times bigger than ours is.
Wow.
And so yet they continue to tax their people. They continue to sort of take in, you know, sort of make citizens pay something for government. And the Norwegians haven't revolted, I think, the way most Alaskans would under that system. So, you know, some things translate well, some don't, but it was a fascinating trip. And I just want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk to your listeners about it.
Yeah, thank you.
Great. Thank you, Adrian. And thank you, Senator. It really was a pleasure to get to know you better.
Yeah. So I've been talking with Brian Holst. He's Executive Director of the Juneau Economic Development Council, and Senator Hollis French out of Anchorage. I will be taking a short break here on the Alaska Identity Project. We'll be coming back talking to Representative Paul Seaton from Homer. So stay tuned. This is Adrienne Lopez and the Alaska Identity Project. Thanks for tuning in tonight and listening to this great show, engaging with and interviewing those making an impact across Alaska. This is KTOO News 104.3 from Alaska's capital in Juneau. If you're listening out there and you want to participate in the show, remember you can always write with questions for the guests at adriennek@gmail.com. You can look for the Alaska Identity Project on Facebook. And on Twitter, it's Alaska ID Project, so you can follow and learn all about the guests we have on the show every week from Thursday from 7 to 8 p.m. on the Alaska time zone. Of course, sometimes we have people listening in from all around the world, so that also helps that after the show we have a link and you can listen to the recording if you don't catch it live. So I should have Paul Seaton, Representative Paul Seaton, on the line. Are you there, Paul?
Yes. Can you hear me here?
Yeah, I can. I can. Thanks for calling in and being a part of this show tonight on the Norway Policy Tour. I'm just going to give a little bit of your bio just so people have a little bit of your background. So just hang on just one second. You were elected to the State House in 2002, and you've proudly served the House District 35 since then. You've been chair of the Fisheries, State Affairs, and Education Committees and currently co-chair of House Resources. You've been in Alaska over 35 years, commercial fisherman by trade, hold a Master of Science in Marine Zoology and a Master of Arts in Teaching, and you have been very involved in the debate surrounding resource development issues and a strong proponent of Alaskans getting their fair share of our resources. So what made you go on this trip, Paul, and what was kind of the motivation behind participating and your interest in Norway?
Well, Norway's, you know, very interesting example of what's happening because it's a far northern country just like Alaska is, and it had oil development finding at about the same time we did here. And so the way they've structured their tax system, you know, was a fairly high tax system, and yet they've been very successful in developing their resources. So it was one of those things that we needed to take a look at and see if there were any parts or pieces of their system that fit into ours.
Yeah. Now, had you participated in trips like this before with the Institute of the North or with other delegations to other countries?
No, I've participated with the Institute of the North in their regional or their statewide conference. You know, it's an annual conference, a dialogue to talk about issues that are important to the state, but I hadn't taken any international trips there.
Okay. So just highlight for us a few of the things that really surprised you or what you most took away. You had a five-day pretty intense agenda there in Norway, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was really interesting because we had a great presentation by basically the president of the university whose talk was on, you know, what made Norwegians. They're philosophical and they're psychological. What's formed them. And that was really good because that gave us the context to say, well, there are some things that just don't fit with our philosophy, but there were other pieces that then we could separate out what would fit and what, you know, just really didn't fit with the philosophy of people in Alaska. So that was a real important thing. And then I guess there were three oil and gas issues that I saw as the important one. One is the leasing structure, how they conduct their leases. The second one, I think you guys talked about a little bit, was state direct financial interest.
Yeah.
And then the third one was the separate accounting of corporate income taxes.
Okay.
Instead of this worldwide apportionment, which is, you know, a big piece. So those three things, and we had dealt with that through a Supreme Court case and all. And so those three things were things that we could very definitely look at as being applicable to Alaska.
Yeah. Could you expand just a little bit on the bidding piece on leases and what how they do it and maybe what we could learn here in Alaska?
Sure. And not all of it is totally different, but
yeah.
what we do is we go out and say, here's an area, give us a bid, you know, a royalty and then a cash bid and put some money on the table, and then you can do with it what you want for the next 10 years, develop it on your schedule, whatever. I mean, we kind of back out of the situation at that point. What Norway does is has a six-year lease with work commitments, but what they do is they say, we're interested in leasing this area, and then the state goes out and contracts for seismic work to be done and gives that seismic work to everybody, to, you know, all the different companies to look at, and then say, okay, give us proposals. So it's not money that is coming forward, but it's actually the proposals for development.
Hmm.
And they pick the best development proposal, the one that's most likely to succeed. And even though it's a six-year lease, if the company that gets the operation of that lease doesn't do 3D seismic, you know, the really intense seismic within the first 2 years, then they lose the lease.
Huh.
So they are on track. And this is one of the things we're talking about is how do we fill the pipe? How do we go forward with operations on the North Slope to actually encourage faster not only exploration, but then getting exploration into production and oil in the pipeline. And so there's a lot of difference between getting some upfront money and then develop it on the company's timetable, or come forward with a timetable and selecting the one that is most advantageous. So, So that's a real difference. And we've done a little of that here in Cook Inlet on the last lease sale. There was Cosmopolitan, which are some leases that there was oil on. We knew there was oil on it. There had been one well drilled on it. And they changed the terms and they said, okay, you have to do these work commitments. You have to, you know, pay more per acre for the lease, minimum fees, et cetera. And so it's not totally outside of what we can do. And so I think that work commitments are something that we'll need to look at carefully as we go forward with leasing.
Yeah. Now, did you have some of these discussions with the delegation there? Was there some consensus on what you were seeing?
Well, I think so. Yeah, I think that. And then also, you know, people talk about Statoil as being a state oil company, but it's really not anymore. What Norway got worried about was Statoil, which was a state oil company, becoming so lucrative and powerful that, you know, its ideas and its future outlook might take over the state, that, which is kind of what has happened in a number of Middle Eastern countries. And so what they did is they privatized it. They retained, you know, about 68% of the shares, but it's a private oil company now. And what they did was they went to the state direct financial interest and have a separate company, not Statoil, which manages that, such as, you know, like the Alaska Railroad, or we have Alaska Housing, and which would direct that financial interest. But all the money flows through to the general fund, to the state, and then the Petroro is the name of that state company that runs that. They just run it, but they don't get the money from it. So it still has some jurisdiction and still has to have budgets approved, so it can't go off on its own. So, you know, those are a couple of things. And then the third one, like I said, was the income tax, right? You know, we have a 9.4% corporate income tax, except on oil companies, we say they can do worldwide apportionment. So they look at their profits around the world and then look at how much oil they produce out of Alaska, and they pay on that proportion.
Hmm.
And what that does is that has us lowering our tax to subsidize bad investments overseas on their corporate income tax, not their oil tax. So there's been a, you know, a real question as to whether that could be done at all. And Norway, when we asked them, it's like, oh yeah, we do separate accounting. They only pay on the, they pay on their profits in this, you know, in Norway. It's not apportioned worldwide or anything. So if we get into looking at changing taxes, you know, oil taxes, I presume that people will be looking at balancing that with having the income taxes actually paid on the profits in Alaska, because Alaska has always been more profitable for the country companies than have many of their investments overseas, which is a kind of different than what we hear. But we always hear, you know, well, you can't count our profitability because we've got a lot of gas investments, and gas isn't as profitable. But since oil companies keep putting tens of billions of dollars into investments overseas that are gas, that are less profitable, we lower our taxes because those are less profitable investments. And it really is kind of a funny way to look at things.
Now, they have a gas line as well. There was something in the report I read about how they manage their gas line. Was there something you saw there that was interesting for Alaska?
Well, it was, and what they've done is they've said that they are going to look at the gas line not as a profit center, but actually as a like a utility.
Oh, okay.
And so they have a regulated return at 7 or 7.5%, and so that's fairly low, except it's really acceptable to retirement funds, pension funds around the world, those kind of insurance companies. Really like a 30-year investment that's got a guaranteed 7% return or 7.5% return. So what's happened over time is that the ownership of the pipelines have gone to investors that are wanting long, stable, moderate returns instead of requiring oil company, much higher return rates.
Now, you've been very involved in fisheries. I know you're a former fisherman and you still are a commercial fisherman. And I know that Norway has done a lot of farm salmon, and they recently had wild stocks. Do you know why they depleted their wild stocks and what, if their farms are in pens or they actually have hatcheries over there?
No, they're actually, they're one of the world leaders in pens.
Okay.
In pens. And, their salmon stocks weren't nearly as vibrant as ours were.
Mm-hmm.
And they made a decision to go with, instead of enhancing their wild stocks, to go with farm fish.
Okay.
That's been detrimental to their, what was left of their wild stocks, but they've looked at it as a different kind of an industry. So, here, we have something to balance off on. In other words, if we would, if it would be deleterious to our wild stocks, we lose. Over there, they didn't have the kind of vibrant wild stocks that they would have much loss in.
Okay.
So, it's one of those trade-offs, and they weren't trading off against much, and we would trade off against a whole lot. So, that's the...
Farm fish is going to still be prohibited, right, in our state?
Farm salmon in our state would be very deleterious to, the economy, not only the marketing, but also the, just all the sea lice and all the other problems that you come from ocean pens.
Yeah. Now, did you guys actually eat some Norwegian salmon?
Oh, there were some every place you went.
They
serve, and they're very proud of their salmon. It's right there in Europe and comes down, and they supply, thousands of tons of their Penrud salmon to Norway, and most of the people in Europe don't have that clear balance where they can have a choice of the two.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. But. Anyway, it was an interesting trip, but that really wasn't much of the focus of our trip.
Yeah. So you guys didn't do any tours of some of the pens?
No.
No, okay.
No, we didn't.
Now, the idea of going on one of these trips is to come back and kind of shape legislation and policy in the next session. Do you think there'll be some issues that will be on the agenda, that this group will come to consensus and I don't know, present a bill or affect something in the state?
I think so. And we've already been talking to the oil and gas division about potential for a lease term. We've got a lease sale coming up for the North Slope, which is going to be maybe one of the bigger lease sales since Prudhoe Bay, because it's after the Great Bear shale oil. That occurred last year. There, all of that other area that has that shale oil potential on it could be up for lease this year. And I'm hoping that instead of just looking at a cash as far as the bonus bids, we could look at the option to take a 8 to 10% state direct financial interest. We'd be just like acting like any other small oil company that invests when they, group their investments together. But the big advantage is what we would do is we would get the information. We would know all the seismic as a partner. We would know all the seismic data. We would know all the downhole well data. We would understand so much better because we would have a great flow of information doing that. And so hopefully, you know, some of these things can work within our system, because that's what I think that we were all looking for. We weren't looking to say, okay, we want to overturn, you know, Alaskan attitudes or Alaskan way of doing things, but how can we incorporate pieces to make our system better?
Yeah, that's ultimately the idea, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Now, have you heard from your constituents? Did anybody say this was a junket trip? I just kind of asked Hollis the same thing.
Actually, I haven't. I've had people ask me about it, and I've told them about the trip, and they're excited that we had learned as much as we had, and that there were some ideas to come back and balance with what we hear here in the state. And so I think they'll make good discussions down in Juneau next year as far as, you know, what's transpiring. I think, you know, every year is a little different, but there's a lot more information this year. And I think this trip has provided some really valuable information.
Yeah, great. Now, what, just real quickly, what other issues do you see besides, you know, some of the things you learned from Norway? What other issues will be in this session for you on the agenda?
Oh, you mean just a diversity of things. I've got a bill in that's looking for giving Alaska manufacturers preference if commercial fishermen buy products that are made in Alaska on an Alaska loan, to reduce their loan rate a little bit. I mean, we have to not only look at the fishing industry as the jobs in the industry, but also as what they can do for the onshore industries, because we've got a lot of people up here that manufacture things for vessels, but if there's no benefit when you get a state loan to buying from in-state versus importing it,
okay.
That didn't seem to be a good job help. We've got the geoduck duck bill, which would allow geoduck farming to be expanded across the Gulf of Alaska, and that would be really good for the farmers in Southeastern as well, because then Alaska could be much more of a player in the international geoduck game, and that would help in marketing and all. So those are a couple of the fisheries issues, you know, that I've got personally in the work there.
Yeah. Well, exciting year coming up.
Yeah,
you guys
do
a lot of work
that
for our state, so it's appreciative.
So, and then we'll be looking at refining some things on the scholarship bill and a funding mechanism for that. You know, we passed some money, put some money in a fund last year, but we didn't pass any mechanism for taking that money out to fund the scholarship program.
Okay.
So we got to figure out how to do that. There's a lot of issues on the table.
Yeah, well, you'll keep busy. Well, thank you, Paul. I really appreciate taking the time tonight to come on the Alaska Identity Project, give us a little insight into the Norway trip. And again, I wish you the best of luck in the upcoming session and the work you do as representative.
Sure, well, thank you. And say hello to, let me say hello to all your listeners. Bye-bye.
Yeah, great. Thanks again. And all the listeners out there, this has been another great week here on the Alaska Identity Project. We hope you'll stay tuned every Thursday from 7 to 8 p.m. here on KTOO News. Next Thursday, we'll have Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, so definitely tune in for that. And you can get this broadcast, the recording, up on the website of KTOO News. Thanks again, and have a good evening.